You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it may be difficult for people looking to get pregnant to get tested for the Zika virus. A doctor tells us why that is and what you can do if you think you might have been exposed to the mosquito-borne virus.
First, getting a college degree is still seen as a ticket to a better life. Higher wages, middle-class status, and opportunity. It's part of the American dream. But for some students from disadvantaged backgrounds and even students from financially stable families, that dream is slipping out of reach as college costs go up and wages go down or stagnate.
In her new book, Higher Education Policy, Professor Sarah Goldrick-Rabb shares the results of a multi-year study that tracked 3,000 students enrolled in public colleges and universities in Wisconsin in 2008. The students were all getting financial aid in the form of Pell Grants or federal aid. Over the course of 6 years, half of them dropped out. Less than 20% finished within 5 years. She says the problem is clear. College is too expensive.
Sarah Goldrick-Rabb is with us now. She's the founding director of the Wisconsin Hope Lab and a professor of higher education and sociology at Temple University. Her new book is called Paying the Price, College Costs, Financial Aid, and the Betrayal of the American Dream. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
Well, I want to start with the 3,000 students that you studied over 6 years, and this was when you were a professor here at the UW-Madison. Tell us about these students and why you chose them.
Well, all of these students began college in 2008. It was September, and they had graduated from high school, and they had decided that college would be an important part of their futures. And so they enrolled at one of the UW system institutions, which could include the colleges, and or they also enrolled in one of the Wisconsin technical colleges across the state. So they were attending the 42 public colleges and universities of the great state of Wisconsin. And all of these people also did something else that really, frankly, takes a lot of hard work, as families know, which is that they filed the FAFSA, which is the application for student aid. And what that information on that form indicated was that their family needed help when it came to paying for college. And they were very fortunate because at the same time, John and Tasha Morgridge, who people in Wisconsin know well as some outstanding philanthropists, they were also looking to make paying for college easier for some kids from Wisconsin families. And all of the people in this study met the criteria for that special new program, which is now known as the Fund for Wisconsin Scholars. And so they became part of a study that I led that was an effort to find out how that program and others like it do in terms of serving those students and helping them succeed.
And can you introduce us to a couple of them? You got to know some of them pretty well because this is over the course of 6 years. Tell us about maybe one or two.
Sure. Yeah. Well, we got to know them by interviewing them, looking at their data, but also by talking to them. And I'll tell you one story about a woman named Chloe, who I actually met for the first time in Madison. And Chloe had grown up in the middle of the state in a town that was mainly centered on a sawmill. And the year that she graduated from high school, the mill closed. And the economics of the town were not great. And Chloe thought it was probably time to go. Her parents had also recently gotten divorced. And when she thought about what she wanted to do, what she decided was she really loved animals. And it wasn't a coincidence that Chloe had grown up around horses and actually was fortunate enough to have a horse of her own. So she decided that she wanted to become a veterinary technician's assistant. She didn't want to be in charge. She just wanted to do some good in the world. And so she went off to a technical college, and she enrolled and filled out that aid application. And lo and behold, it revealed that her family's financial circumstances were weak enough that she would qualify for the federal Pell Grant. But the problem is that even though she got the federal Pell Grant and she got a little bit of state grant money as well, she faced a price of college that was well beyond her reach. The government estimated that her family could contribute a little over $2,000 to college, yet the college presented her with a bill that even after all the grants and scholarships were done was over $10,000 for a single year. And while we might think this is uncommon, especially for two-year college students, it's not. She's actually very similar to the national average.
I want to talk about those Pell Grants you mentioned, because in the past it used to be that the Pell Grants did end up covering most of the need for students who couldn't pay the full tuition. And it seems as though that the model has shifted, or the economics have shifted of college. Tell us about how Pell Grants have functioned then and now.
Well, Pell Grants were designed to ensure that families like those that Chloe grew up in didn't have to take out any loans for college. The Pell Grant was supposed to cover everything. And back when the program began in the early 1970s, it covered the price of attending a two-year college fully. And it covered about three-quarters of the cost of attending a public four-year institution. Today, as you suggested, the purchasing power, the value of that grant, has eroded so that it only covers about a third of the cost of attending a public four-year institution and about 60% of the cost of attending a two-year college. And one of the reasons is that the states have not continued to join the federal government in financing higher education. They pulled back on many of their resources, forcing the price of college at the state institutions up, driving up tuition. And as a result, even though the federal government has modestly increased the maximum Pell from year to year, it's basically buying less and less. It's like you bought a Groupon, but the value of that Groupon for the restaurant you want to go to is deteriorating by the day. So that by the time you actually use it, it's really not paying for much.
We always hear about how college is so expensive today. How much more expensive today is it than it used to be maybe in the 80s or 90s?
Yeah, it's substantially more expensive. You know, I profiled these students and I looked back. You know, they were 18 years old when they started in 2008, and they faced out-of-pocket costs for families making less than $25,000 a year. People were being left with bills that were over $10,000 a year at state institutions. And if they had gone to college the year that they were born, which was primarily around 1990, that price would have been very close to zero. So things have changed a ton, and it has to do with states pulling back on what they will pay on a per-student basis for college and the failure to continue to increase spending on need-based financial aid as more and more people have needed it.
We're talking with Sarah Goldrick-Rabb right now. You might remember her as a professor from the UW-Madison, and she's talking about research that she did here in Wisconsin at the UW. Now she's at Temple University, where she's a professor of higher education, and her new book is out. We're talking about that right now. It's called Paying the Price, College Costs, Financial Aid, and the Betrayal of the American Dream. And Sarah, one thing you get into is what happens to these students when they don't have the money to make ends meet to pay for, you know, not just the tuition, but the things that go along with living, things like food and book costs and maybe supporting their families. What happens to these students, some of them?
Well, this was one of the hardest parts about this study. I had sent graduate students out to do some of the interviews, and one of them came back to me in the fall of 2008, and she says, I don't know what to do. She said, I met a student today, and I asked her how college was going. I asked her what her biggest challenge was. And the student, who was 18 years old, turned to her, and she said, eating. My biggest challenge is eating. I don't have enough food to eat, and I can't focus on school. And that was the moment when my research team realized that so much of this country was missing the real picture by talking about tuition. The cost of living in this country is substantial, and college students, some of them, are going without their basic needs met. We've explored this further beyond Wisconsin since that time in several studies, and it is very clear that hunger and homelessness are not strangers to undergraduates now, which is really pretty devastating.
And you also point out that the financial aid formula for things like the Pell Grant, it assumes that money is moving from families to students, but sometimes the students are the one who are helping to support the family.
That's right. You know, Wisconsin's got a lot of wonderful families that work together to stay together and make ends meet, and so do people all over the country. But the financial aid system is remarkably presumptuous. It produces this expected family contribution, which assumes that your parents are going to give you resources. But in many cases, to make ends meet, students have been working to support their families even while in high school. And when they go to college, they keep doing the same thing. Their parents worked hard to get them to college, and they repay them even when they're trying to buy books and things by sending them bits and pieces of money or sometimes paying bills. And, you know, it puts the students in a really difficult situation at the same time that they're happy to do it. it means they often go without the things they actually need.
Sarah Goldrick-Rabb is with us right now. She's the author of the book Paying the Price, College Costs, Financial Aid, and the Betrayal of the American Dream. She's a professor of higher education policy at Temple University.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you hearing your story, your family's story right now? Is a college education within reach for your kids when it comes to the price tag? What solutions would you like to see to make college affordable for more people? To make it affordable, maybe, for you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And Sarah Goldrick-Rabb stays with us. She's the author of the new book, Paying the Price, College Costs, Financial Aid, and the Betrayal of the American Dream. She did a lot of research for this book in Wisconsin at UW-Madison. And she's a professor of higher education policy right now at Temple University. And she says the price tag on a college degree, college education, is getting out of reach for growing numbers of Americans, and it's time to make a change.
We want to hear your story at 800-642-1234. How are you, how is your family working to pay for higher education, whether that's a university, a college, technical college? Is higher education out of reach for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Sarah, I want to get to our callers quickly, but before we do, can you tell us what you found? This was a study that took place over 6 years. What happened to these students who were receiving financial aid and Pell Grants?
Well, all of these students came to college to get some sort of credential, and only half of them did over the next 6 years. By a credential, I mean a certificate, an associate degree, or a bachelor's degree. And those who didn't, the vast majority of them, ended up in debt with nothing to show for it except that student loan bill that keeps coming due. And I think that's the hardest lesson of all from the study, is to watch people take a chance on getting an education only to find out they get nothing but somebody coming after them to collect.
I want to get to our callers now. We've got Paula first joining us in Appleton. Paula, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that, you know, in our family situation, it's going to be very challenging to help assist our kids go to college. We are both still dealing with our own student loan debt, which wasn't outrageous when we did it. We never took anything more than the minimum that we needed to get through. We both worked through our degrees. We both have jobs in our fields. Unfortunately, the jobs in our fields don't pay what our education actually costs. So for us, you know, and we remember eating crackers because there was no money for food. You know, we always had shelter, but our families, both of us were first generation. Our families did not have a lot to contribute. We really worked hard to get that education. We would love to be able to make that easier for our kids, and I don't know that having them have a debt-free education is necessarily the answer, but having them have an education where the debt is minimal, where they could at least still function post-graduation, because those entry-level jobs just don't pay what you go to school, what you pay tuition for.
And Paula, thank you so much for calling and sharing what you went through and what you're thinking about for your kids. A couple of things, you know, that brought up, Sarah. One is, I'm curious about whether the jobs that are available when people do make it through college, if they match the debt load that they may have. And also wonder if we could start talking about some of the plans that are out there to change things. One of them, one possibility is debt-free college. What do you want to start with?
Well, the first thing is I want the caller to know that she's not alone in facing a difficult situation when the financial aid calculations don't even take into account your existing debt. It's really a remarkable thing when they size up your economic ability to pay for college and won't consider the debt you're already in from your prior education. I think it's also the case that, you know, look, you should be able to major in something and take on as a career something that you love. And you shouldn't have to be so concerned that you make an enormous amount of money afterwards so you can pay off an enormous amount of debt. I agree with her. I don't know that the goal is to have no debt of any kind for anybody who attends a public institution. That's why I actually do prefer the framing, though, of saying, let's make the first couple of years. I call it the first degree free. And the reason for that is that you ought to be able to get the associate degree under your belt so you know how to do college and you know what you're getting from it before you start taking on the risk involved of using debt to finance it. And that's what's changed over time. It used to be that if you were unsure or, you know, not confident that your family could afford it, you could go to community college, go to a technical college, you could try it out, and if it didn't work, you would leave with no debt. That's over. There is no risk-free option anymore, and that's scary.
Why don't you like the idea of a debt-free college? Because I think a lot of parents, that sounds pretty appealing.
Sure, but you know, the truth is debt's a symptom. It's not the actual problem. So if you are somebody from a decent, you know, from a family that's earning a decent income and you have a decent job, making minimal payments on a small amount of debt is entirely doable. It's much more important right now that we ensure that the folks who most can't handle the debt, like I said, the people on the lower income side of the distribution who are pursuing associate degrees, that they are able to go risk-free. And so while it sounds kind of funny, and I know how backwards this sounds, but that's because higher ed finance is so difficult and so complicated, it's actually the case that making a few years of college free is more targeted to those who really need it than debt-free for everybody is.
Paula, thanks a lot for calling. I really appreciate your story. And let's go next to Frank joining us in Milwaukee. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Frank. Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
What did you want to share?
Sure. So, I had a similar experience to the previous caller. You know, I had to actually contribute a lot to my family while I was going to college. So a lot of the income that I was earning while in college was not going to pay for my tuition and my books and my food. It was actually going back home. And because of that fact, you know, I had to, you know, work sometimes two jobs during the semester to kind of try and take care of both things at the same time. And obviously that kind of leads to a cycle, not a positive cycle, right, that a normal student should be in when they're in college, let alone a trickle-down effect that ultimately led me to even have to take an additional year of college, which, is kind of, you know, counterproductive in that sense. And I agree with also the previous comments when it came to financial aid calculation and FAFSA, because it was my sense that the large majority of college students are really in that huge middle bracket where their family just literally made enough to survive, but because of that fact, they're in a sense penalized and then have to contribute or are held accountable to this larger tuition responsibility that they then have to carry on with them. And then, you know, that college debt is just simply not relative or manageable to the entry-level jobs and what they're paying. So,
Frank, thank you so much for calling and sharing your story. Sarah, what strikes you about what Frank had to say?
Well, what strikes me, and Frank, thank you for sharing your story, because I have to tell you that a lot of students who are giving money to their families these days, frankly, are not talking about it. And to just let people know this is happening is important. This afternoon, I published a piece in The Atlantic about how the financial aid system betrays families, and it's all about these issues with a couple of stories from students in the book. And I just think it's so important that people start talking about this so that we can get rid of these stereotypes where everybody is just getting their mom and dad to pay for things.
Frank, thanks again for that. And Sarah, as we get close to the end of our time together, I want to catch up with a story you began with, a student named Chloe. What happened to her?
Yeah, well, things didn't work out so well. Unfortunately, you know, in order to pay those bills, she took on two jobs. She was working at Kohl's and PetSmart, and she tried to tighten her belt by living a little further from campus where things were cheaper and living with her boyfriend. She was commuting all over the place. There wasn't enough time in the day, and she started to do badly in school. She realized that. She knew she wanted to do better, so she tried to take on a student loan. It didn't arrive for a month and a half. And by that point, her grades had tanked. She was placed on academic probation, and she dropped out. And unfortunately, years later, she's never found her way back into college. She is one of those with debt and no degree. And now she's in the Navy, and you know, she likes it a lot. She feels that she gets three square meals a day and a roof over her head, which she felt being in college, she couldn't assure those things. So she feels better in that sense. But it's very, very clear she wants to go back to school, doesn't see a route. However, the University of Phoenix keeps calling her to talk about her GI benefits. And that's concerning for so many reasons.
Yeah, her story was striking to me because she kept coming back to getting 8 hours of sleep in the military. To be that happy about 8 hours of sleep lets you know that she wasn't sleeping a heck of a lot when she was trying to go through school.
Yeah, it was very hard to watch.
So one of the things you say that gets at Chloe's story is that you want to make it easier for students to get money quickly to help them stay at school. Tell us about some of your ideas there.
Yeah, well, it's called emergency aid, and that's just a flexible aid that can be delivered fast and usually outside of the financial aid system. And I'm hoping your listeners will be interested in something. Since I left the University of Wisconsin, I've been thinking a lot about these students and everything that's going on in their lives. So I partnered with a couple of friends, and we made a new nonprofit, and we're actually running something now called the FAST Fund. And I staked it with 5% of my income now, and we're fundraising for more. And what we're doing is we're giving out emergency aid very quickly to students at three institutions to begin with. And those schools are Milwaukee Area Technical College, Bunker Hill Community College in Boston, and students in the Madison area, the public school district. And people can give to that. The way that the money is going to the students, though, is that instead of going to administrators at colleges, we're giving the money directly to teachers. And the teachers are the ones in the classrooms with the students who see these problems. So FAST, while it's quick, stands for Faculty and Students Together. And this is just a small effort to try to prevent some of the damage that's happening when students really go without the resources they need.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us. Appreciate your time. That was Sarah Goldick-Rabb, the author of the book Paying the Price, College Costs, Financial Aid, and the Betrayal of the American Dream. A lot of the research for the book done in Wisconsin at UW-Madison. She's a professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University. You can share your stories about paying for college on the Central Time Facebook page.